Before we get started, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to talk with us tonight. One of my colleagues will be joining us shortly. His name is Jeff Smith, and we might be joined by another individual named Tom Stanton from our research group. Again, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I know there's probably other things you could be doing right now, like eating dinner or hanging out with
watching a Laker game, right?
Yeah, lots of other things you'd rather be doing than talking to us. But we do appreciate it. The knowledge of, you know, your time to AmeriQuest could potentially help our investigation. I'm going to give you the spiel about the FDIC. I don't know how much you know about us, but the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was created out of the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act of 2009, and there's 22 specific items that we need to look at. Hello?
George?
Hello? Yes.
Sorry, I just joined the call. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay. And Mr. Parker, we've just been joined by my associate, Jeff Smith.
How are you doing, Mr. Smith?
Good. Yourself?
Okay.
Just going back to the kind of purpose of the FDIC, we were commissioned by Congress to look at the causes of the financial crisis, and we were given a list of 22 specific things to look at. First among those on that list is fraud and abuse, specifically as it relates to the mortgage market. Now, Mr. Parker, I read Mike Hudson's article. I know you worked for AmeriQuest as the head of the mortgage investigation and joined them in 2003. But before we delve into that, if I could just get a brief professional background of you, starting with your education and working forward up to your time with AmeriQuest.
Okay. I'm a graduate of Grambling State University with a degree in political science. I am currently scheduled to graduate next Friday from the University of Phoenix with a master's in business administration. I have over 15 plus years in the mortgage industry.
Did you say 15 or 50? 15 plus. What was the name of your undergraduate degree or undergraduate college?
Grambling State University. I don't want to put you on speaker because I'm on a cell phone, so I don't know if that would work. You know, that would carry better if I was on the speaker or what. I don't know.
Oh no, you're fine. You're fine.
Okay. Yeah, I graduated from Grambling State University in Louisiana with a degree in political science. And currently I'm enrolled at the University of Phoenix, scheduled to graduate next Friday, June 4th, with a degree in master's degree in business administration. Professional background. I've worked in quality control. I worked for an extended period of time with California Federal Bank, which is no longer in business, in the quality control department, as a quality control auditor. I actually started from the bottom, working my way up, becoming familiar with the loan files, and then slowly advanced as I gained more knowledge and took advantage of their career mapping program. Worked for CalFed for an extended period of time, left there, went to my next stop on the mortgage path was with, I'm getting feedback. Are you getting feedback?
Yeah. Jeff, are you on speaker or?
Let me mute it to see if that's better. Hold on just one second.
Okay. All right, that's actually much better.
Okay, yeah, I left my next stop on the mortgage path with Ames Home Loans, which is no longer in business, and I worked in the quality control department. It was at Ames that they moved me into fraud investigations. I became the go-to person for fraud investigations within the body of the quality control department, which means I routinely met with senior management, the VPs of capital markets, secondary marketing, as they call it at Ames, internal audit department, the general counsel, VP of risk management, quality control management, and just and VPs that represented the two funding channels, the lending channel, which was our wholesale and retail division. So we would meet on a weekly basis and go over the you know, the fraud issues in the company that the company was facing, and discuss the root causes and how would those issues be addressed, and discuss resolutions. And of course, I was responsible for coordinating the investigations and pulling together all the information and interacting. And with Ames, it was more focused on the wholesale side, where we dealt with a lot of brokers, because our business channel, our business was really on, more on the wholesale as opposed to the retail. It wasn't a strong retail brand. It wasn't a strong retail branch representation, so I really focused a lot on wholesale. But I did that for a while, and while I was at Ames, I got a chance to interact with a lot of different agencies. I interact with the governmental agencies that regulated the mortgage industry, the broker industry
here in California. Can you be a little bit more specific about that?
I'm sorry, I can understand you.
Can you be a little bit more specific about the regulatory agencies you dealt with?
Yeah, the agencies, like in California, you have Department of Real Estate Agency. Those would be the agencies that for each state that that monitors and regulates that industry, the broker industry, the mortgage broker industry. Those are the agencies that I dealt with. I don't remember the name specifically. But those would be the people that I would interact with. Basically, what I did in terms of let me explain to you this so you can get a grip of understanding of where I'm coming from. At Ames, whenever we had a problem with the brokers, I would draft a letter, send it to the broker, detailing what the issues were. And have them remind them of the provision in their broker agreements with the company to indemnify us against any losses. Also, make them aware of their buyback obligations so that they could resolve this issue. And one of the things that that I did in that process was I would always copy the agency of that state that regulated the broker industry, so that they'll be aware that this problem has been brought to the broker's attention, and that we were giving the brokers a certain window period to, you know, to resolve that issue, and that was the process that we used at Ames in order to deal with issues that were, whether they were fraud issues that were questionable, you know, and kick it back to the broker and let them, you know, resolve that issue. So And that was the purpose. And there was one case where I dealt with, and there was FBI agent, I believe it was. They were doing some undercover stuff, and it was back, I believe, in the Detroit, Michigan area, where there was a group that were they were going out to these areas that were abandoned and taking these old buildings and not renovating, but fix them up on the outside, on the exterior, so that they can look as if they were inhabited. And then take, you know, and then work their scheme, you know, pretend that they were property, and then use that to get a final straw buyer, and use that picture of the property and the straw buyer to use that at the set up the transaction and do a loan through the company. So that was I was very helpful with my department. We were very helpful in giving them information, you know, about the people that were represented on those transactions. So I've had that kind of experience.
Okay, so they were basically flipping the property then, inflating the value, kind of making it look like it was more of a house than it actually was.
Right, exactly. They were, you know, no one actually, I mean, it was front property, you know, it was vacated property, and they were just using it to actually structure a transaction to move it through the lender. And what really tipped it off was that you would have these, you know, we would send a letter, not me, but the company, when the borrowers realized that the agreement that they had with the perpetrators, to the perpetrators said, well, we'll take care of it. We just need you to help us structure this deal. We'll give you X amount of dollars for it, and then we'll take over so you don't have to never worry about anything. But what happened was they walk away, leave the straw buyer hanging, and the straw buyer gets a letter from the lender saying that, hey, you know, you owe this and blah, 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 and then that's when they start talking. You know, because things didn't go the way it was supposed to. And they said, well, I don't really have this loan. I was told that, you know, they wanted to use my information. They wanted me to help them do this. And in exchange, I did that. And, you know, and that information would have been was handled through our legal department. The facts and the findings that we gathered through those investigations was submitted to the legal department. And they would take it from that point on.
Now, and about what time was that? Like, do you remember a year?
Because I left America, I mean, Ames, it had to be in the latter part, between the year 1999, maybe, I would say between 2000 and 2003, because I left, actually 2000 and 2002, because I left Ames in 2002, December 2002 was my last month with Ames, and then I started with AmeriQuest in January of 2003.
Okay.
So it had to be in that time period.
Okay. Now let me just back up for half a second and get some dates. When did you graduate your undergraduate degree?
In 1976.
1976.
Right.
And when did you start working for California Fed?
1988, 89. And the reason I can say that, my daughter was born when I started. She just graduated from UC Berkeley.
Okay, very nice. And when did you start working for Ames?
In January of 2000 and, I'm sorry, January 2003, January 2003, yeah.
For Ames?
Oh, no, not for Ames. No, I'm sorry, not for Ames. In Ames, I started in January. It was in 19, had to be in 1998 or 99. I think it was
1998,
99. Right.
What did you do between 1976 and 1988?
What did I do between 1988 and 96?
No, from when you graduated college in 1976 to 1988.
Oh, I worked in a different varieties of jobs. I worked. I was in the. I worked for the Broadway department stores. Actually, let me go back. I worked for Security Pacific Bank, which no longer exists, as a teller. Then from there, I my next job, I went to work for the Broadway department stores, which was one of the stores that were managed and ran by the Carter Hawley Hill Corporation. At working for them, I was promoted to what's called a department manager, and I did that for a while. Then I left from there, and I went into the fast food industry. I went through the Urban League. I was able to get a trainee position with McDonald's Corporation, not the franchise, but the corporation, to go through their management training program. And so I did a stint with McDonald's stores in the Los Angeles area. After that I went to, let's see, after I left McDonald's, that's when I got into, I started working for CalFed. That was my next stop.
Okay. And then what did you do between, did you work for CalFed from 1988-89 through 1998-1999?
Yeah, let me pull my resume because that would give you, I can give you more precise dates.
You don't need to be exact. I'm just trying to get a
feel.
Yeah, just for your professional background.
Right. Yeah, I have a lot of retail. I can give you a summary. So I have a lot of retail experience in my background. A lot of management. I once worked for Goodyear, which I didn't put in. I did once work for Goodyear's tire and rubber as a retail sales manager. Most of my retail experience prior to getting into the mortgage industry have been in the what you call the fast food, the the automotive service, and the banking, retail banking. So that's where my experience is.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, let's pick back up in January 2003. You begin working for AmeriQuest. Did they seek you out, or did you seek them out?
No, actually, a headhunter that AmeriQuest employed to look for a person to bring in to fill that position contacted me when I was at Ames. Jim Nichols is his name. Jim Nichols. I think the name of his business is Nichols and Associates, and he was out of Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a call. I got a call, received a call from him one day at work, and he asked me if I was interested in, making a change. There was this company in Orange County. I didn't know anything about AmeriQuest at that time.
Mm-hmm.
If I was interested in, making a change, and they're looking for a strong person to come in and develop and build a fraud investigation unit. And, of course, that was an opportunity, and I was doing that at Ames and enjoyed it, and so why not? It's more money, and it's an opportunity to go in and actually build a fraud investigation unit utilize all the resources that I had at my disposal, as well as basically put my stamp on it.
Now, were you hired to be the head of the mortgage fraud investigation then?
Yes. I was hired in to come in. That didn't exist. When I was brought in, that wasn't a fraud investigation unit. Fraud investigation matters was handled through the internal control department, which was under the legal department.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your time. You get hired January of 2003. According to Mike Hudson's article, the company was on the verge of becoming the nation's largest subprime lender. What can you tell me about the company's use of the subprime loan, and as it relates to fraud and potentially, the subprime loan being a vehicle for mortgage fraud?
Well, I guess the best way for me to answer that question is kind of to give you an understanding, just tell you the details of what really happened, what I saw from my perspective coming in. When I came in, I was under the impression that AmeriQuest was very serious about fraud investigations, and they gave me this nice big office and treated me with carte blanche. After being at AmeriQuest for about a month, because I started on January 6th, 2003, and it was around February the 4th or the 5th of that 2003 that we uncovered a major fraud problem in our one of our Michigan branch, which was the Grand Rapids branch. And interesting, when I came in, when I started AmeriQuest, the Grand Rapids investigation was being handled by, actually was sitting on someone's desk. They knew that that there was a problem there. There was speculations, suspicions that the branch personnel was working with some appraisers in the Michigan area, but no one knew how to really, they weren't able to connect the dots. So when I came in, I was able to connect the dots and just run some reports and basically massage the data and filter it and see that there was a relationship between certain appraisals were being used more than any of the other appraisals. And then also there was a pattern where you had the same property being submitted two or three times before it actually hit. Case in point, you take a property that's submitted once, and the report shows that it would decline because the appraised value wasn't there. Now that same property a week later or 2 weeks later has been resubmitted, and the value is substantially higher, and property does not appreciate that quick. So, I saw that repeated pattern. Then also I saw the fees that were being paid to this certain group of appraisers. They were higher than what would normally be paid to an appraiser And I know that they, you know, that, you know, they would tell you, well, there's the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and that's the reason why these fees are higher. But no, these fees were substantially higher. And so when I massaged the data, I was able to show those patterns, and then I submitted their report to management, senior management, and then we had a meeting with the general counsel, who was Tom Noto, Adam Bass, who was he was, you know, the owner's nephew at that time, and Dale Dillingham, who was my immediate boss in legal, and Ginger Crawford, and Joanne Davies, who was a lawyer from outside with Buchalter law firm, and there were maybe a couple more people, I don't recall. But we had a meeting, and the decision was made that we need to go to Grand Rapids. And so what we did was we basically drilled down the information, isolated the perpetrators, the people who loans we knew that value had been boosted. And when we went in, we, you know, established a lineup of who we wanted to interview first. And one of the first concerns was to make sure that there was no tip-off that we were coming. So what we did was we talked to a manager in another area outside the Michigan area to let them know that we were coming. So we went to the branch that morning. As soon as the branch opened, we were there, and we went in and introduced ourselves, and we told the branch manager basically that we were here because there were some concerns about, you know, the way things were being done in this particular location, and we wanted to talk to the staff. And so so when they came in, and we, you know, we told them who we wanted to talk to, and we wanted anybody need to go to lunch, let us know, because we were going to order lunch out. We were going to bring lunch in, so we really didn't want anybody to leave. And if you had child care issues or emergencies or whatever, let us know.
Mr. Parker, I don't mean to cut you off, but kind of in the interest of time, I don't need every specific detail about each fraud investigation that you did. Basically, sure. You know, I understand from the article that you guys went in, they were inflating the loan applicants' home values, and you guys broke it down. And what sounded like a big win for the company, you found out to be different.
Yeah, I found out to be different because we had to bring those loans back in-house. And that means the loan, we had repurchase obligations, so those loans had been sold to investors.
Right.
And that means that the company had to contact those investors and bring those loans back in. Where that became problematic was that there were people that that were calling that that had tried to get along with another lender and found out that the appraised value that was used by AmeriQuest had been significantly higher, and that the property wasn't really what we had appraised it at, so they were upside down. So those calls were channeled to me, you know, and I had to handle those calls. So the reason I bring Michigan is significant is because it was soon after Michigan when things started turning south for me, when the company began to, start to circumvent me in my department, because that was not what, you know, I guess we weren't supposed to find that kind of fraud.
Now, when you say investors, you had to call the investors, had these loans been securitized in some sort of bond at this point, and that's why you had to contact the investors, or the actual physical investors in the property?
Yeah, well, the company handled that. That was handled through our legal department. I didn't get involved in that. My job was just to identify the loans that were, problematic, and give them a report detailing the extent of the, you know, of the problem and the number of loans, and give them a loan by loan breakdown of what each loan, what the problems were in each particular loan. That was my responsibility.
Now, sir, did you work at corporate headquarters?
Yes, I did.
And did you have, I guess, not day-to-day interaction, but did you have fairly regular interaction with corporate management?
Yes, I did.
Are we talking CEO level or lower?
My report, I did a fraud investigation. Every investigation that would refer to our department, I issued a fraud investigation report, which the CEO, the general counsel, the head of HR, all the senior management people that were in my particular reporting structure were copied on it. And there were times when Adam Bass was copied on it, but certainly Tom Noto, Dale Dillingham, who was I was his direct report when we were in the legal department, were copied on it, as well as the senior management in HR and senior management in operations and in the field were copied on our report.
Do you have, this is Jeff Smith, do you have copies of any of those documents?
No, I don't have copies of those documents because there was all those documents were under attorney-client privilege.
Okay.
Meaning they're property of AmeriQuest or they're attorney-client privilege with you and a private counsel?
No, AmeriQuest.
AmeriQuest, okay.
Okay, but what you're saying is that, I mean, you communicated the evidence that you found that seemed to be fairly conclusive of fraud, and you communicated that to senior management on a regular basis, and basically they didn't do anything about it?
They didn't do anything about it, yeah. I mean, that the problem continued to exist. But yeah, I did. All my reports went to senior management. That was my function was to investigate allegations of fraud, systemic fraud, not the small stuff, but the large scale fraud to see if there was a problem and report back to management. And when I report to management, they would take it from there.
How conclusive was this evidence of fraud?
Very conclusive. Where we went into the branch where we actually was able to go into the desk of some of the loan account executives and pull out templates where they used to lift information from one document and place it on another.
And, oh, good heavens. Okay.
Yeah, very no, we when we we found evidence. When we did our investigation, one of the things we had to be very careful was that we had to make sure that we had the evidence to support, and that's why we everything that we did was we worked with outside counsel to advise on what we were doing, but and make sure that when I issued my report that I had the evidence to show, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bush.
Approximately how many reports did you forward to, I guess, what you call the senior management level during the course of your tenure at AmeriQuest?
That's a good question. Because, again, the switch is what I refer to it occurred in December. Occurred in the midpoint of 2004 or the latter part of 2004.
Okay.
When they dissolved they removed the fraud investigation unit from underneath the legal department and created a new division called business controls.
Okay.
But prior to that, I would say, it was numerous. 15, 20. I can't give you a number because it's been a while, but it was numerous.
I mean, give me a ballpark. Are we talking more than 100?
No. No.
Less than 50?
No, I would say anywhere between, it could be 25 to 50, anywhere in that neighborhood. You know, I'm not saying, it depends. It's like I say, understand that we didn't deal with this. We dealt with the systemic fraud, so we didn't deal with the isolated incidents.
All right, now, when you mentioned, you said you didn't deal with the small stuff. By small stuff, do you mean kind of the isolated borrower fraud where the borrower is just kind of inflating the value or the inflating their income or their assets to get the loan?
Right. Right. We would look at it, and if we saw that it was an isolated situation where it wasn't systemic, then we would refer it to, the appropriate department, back to management. But my department basically, our function was to we take any allegation of fraud, certainly take any allegation of fraud as serious, and you just turn look at that allegation and see if there are other evidence of that allegation present in any of the other files that originated out of a particular branch, and to see how widespread it is before you dismiss it as being just an isolated situation.
And you said you dealt with the systemic fraud, so that was kind of the larger scale fraud where you had, you know, insiders at AmeriQuest doing multiple loans with fraud in them, correct?
Correct, correct.
Okay.
From debt omission to boosting appraisals, from taking financial statements to prove cash reserves, lifting information, from one document to another, forging borrower signatures to, writing on the stated documents letters to writing stated documents letters to qualify a borrower, saying, misstating a borrower's income. But when you asked earlier and you alluded to evidence, those are the kind of things that documents that we produce for every investigation. If we said there was error omission, if there was forgery, or if there was documents that had been manipulated, we had copies of it. So it wasn't based on what we thought; it was based on evidence.
Right.
Out of those 25 to 50 cases that were opened and where you found conclusive fraud, let's just say, how many of those were actually referred out to an enforcement agency that could take criminal action?
Because it never got back to me, but I can tell you from what I understand, I had never heard of any action being taken outside. I can tell you this, that that was a discussion that I had with Deborah McDonald, who was the, at that time, manager of quality control, and actually she became my manager at one point. And that was an issue that we felt that there was a case where identity theft alone had came up, where that it was identified that this borrower, the social and the security number and this borrower didn't go together. So we had a discussion about, well, why don't, we call the FBI. So I did make a phone call to the local FBI in the Los Angeles area. I don't remember his name. It's been that whatever
right.
A while ago. But anyway, and I told him what we had found and, basically wanted to find out, what should we do? And he suggested that, I guess because we're not FDIC at that time, we're not FDIC, so we're not really bound to any mandate that we have to report it. But I'm just thinking that, we should do a SARS report in order to let someone know what's going on. So anyway, I went back and I told Deborah McDonald, who was my boss at that time, because through the realignment of business, putting us in business control, and told her what I said. And so she had me contact the legal department, which I did. And I don't have my notes here with me, but I think her name was Erin. I don't remember Erin's last name, but she was an attorney. So I ran it by her. I said, Erin, we have this problem. What should we do? Because, the FBI said it would be probably to our advantage to report, because what happens if the borrower later on find out that AmeriQuest had knowledge of this and didn't, report it to the authorities? So her comeback to me was that basically we can always say that, we, in the course of doing business, we had problems with this loan, so we declined the loan. And that was it.
Hmm.
And that threw me, because it's, that you can basically just say, okay, it's all right. We can just dismiss it as, well, we declined the loan. So that would be our official version when it came to it. If there's any question as to why we didn't report it, well, we just didn't do the loan. We declined it.
Interesting. So in essence, the response to not reporting it would be fraudulent.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
And of those 25 to 50 cases, how many of those cases resulted in triggering the part of the contract related to investors whereby those investors would, be able to unwind the transaction?
I really couldn't tell you because I was shielded away from certain aspects. When I handed it off to you know, to senior management unless I was directly involved. It was being handled by someone else. I really couldn't tell you that, but I can just tell you that based on from what I've seen and, you know, being in the loop, I never heard of anybody coming back and saying that we, you know, we did anything about, you know, the loan. I can give you a case in point. There was a case right here in this Orange County where we had a disgruntled employee of a broker that were receiving printouts of AmeriQuest borrowers' loan screens. And he got kicked off because he wasn't getting his money, I guess, with his partner. So he decided to be a whistleblower. And he called in, and the call was transferred to me, and I handled it. And he provided us proof of AmeriQuest proprietary information, borrower's information, with their account numbers and Social Security numbers, address. And so I challenged that to management and say, hey, look, we have a problem. So everybody became very concerned, which is good. And what happened was this guy ended up telling us that this process has been going on for a long time. But the problem was the copy that he provided us, AmeriQuest could not, with the system they had in place, find out who generated those screen prints, you know, because there wasn't any footprints, but they knew it was ours. And according to this source, this had been going on for a very long time, very long time. So we had a big management meeting, conference call, and I remember Adam Bass was in there on that conference call, and I forgot the other manager at that time. He was the CEO. He was on that call. All the powers that be, I believe Jeff Fachowski, who's our risk management person, was on that call. All senior management that would have an interest, a stake in what was going on was on that call. And the problem that they had was the IT department could not, for the life of them, figure out who was generating those screen prints. They knew it was ours, but they couldn't tell. So that was a problem. Now, there was a person that was new to the company. I don't know whatever happened to her, but she indicated that we had a responsibility to let the borrowers know that their confidential information may have been compromised. Now, did AmeriQuest do that? To my knowledge, no.
Mr. Parker, were you ever told specifically not to file? I know you guys weren't bound by FDIC regulation. You weren't FDIC insured, and thus were not bound by the Bank Secrecy Act. But were you ever told specifically not to file a SAR or not to report anything to law enforcement?
No, I was never told not to do that. And I was the way we had a reporting structure. Everything that I did had to go through the legal department. I mean, everything that I did had to be approved by my counsel. So my flexibility in terms of my being able to do something like that was very limited. I was very limited and guarded.
Did you ever come across where you recommended something, either implementation of some sort of underwriting software or fraud detection software, where management said, no, we're not interested?
No. We were able to get Choice Point. I know I think you guys are probably familiar with Choice Point.
Right.
We were able to get Choice Point. We had the senior management of Choice Point from, I think they were in Boca Raton, Florida, fly down to our corporate office and do a presentation, and we ended up going with Choice Point. And that turned out to be a very valuable tool for fraud investigations, and there were times when we would get special requests to from the legal department to run some data through the Choice Point and to give them some feedback on some situations.
Now, when you say that was a valuable tool, do you mean that was a valuable tool in running just properties to see, you know, what was publicly available on that property, like who might be living there now? Or were you running AmeriQuest or employees or potential employees to see whether or not they had a criminal background?
No, it was used for mortgage investigations only.
Was there... did you ever, was there a policy in place in AmeriQuest where employees who are dealing with loans, be it a loan officer, processor, quality control person, were run for having a criminal background?
I've never ran a report, a criminal background report on anybody, any employees, you know, but there were, you know, rumors and different inferences that were employees that had criminal backgrounds at some of the branches, I believe, namely Florida. That's probably what you may be alluding to. But I've certainly, my department, as far as being asked to confirm that using, you know, software, no, we never had that request.
No, go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to ask you, do you feel as though the senior management at AmeriQuest was encouraging conduct on the part of its salespeople that would could be interpreted as being fraudulent?
I would answer that question. I would say they definitely didn't do anything to discourage it. And even though they said do the right thing, I would just ask you this question. Would you put the fox in charge of the in-house? And this is what happened with my department, with fraud investigations, when they took us from underneath the legal department and created the business control division. The person that was in charge of the business control division, which was overseeing the fraud investigation unit and the quality control department, was a salesperson. That was Renee Dean. She was with Capital Markets. And so, you know, that, you know, and then one of the first things, actions she took was she dismantled the compliance unit, which was a unit that was regularly out in the branches issuing reports on, you know, other issues, you know, regulatory issues, the quality of loans that's been done and that have been, you know, done in the branch, as well as making sure that we were in compliance with, you know, state law, you know, as far as posting regulatory federal law, as far as posting documents for customers to see, and just our file retention procedures and all the in-house stuff that should be done in a branch. She dismantled that department because they would issue a scorecard. And when one of the things that I learned when I came aboard, and Ron Reed is the gentleman you may, I don't know if you're interested in talking to him, but he was the manager of the compliance unit. And when I got there, it was interesting that some of the things that I had already, that I started immediately seeing had been reported on by the compliance unit. But as Ron, it was communicated to me by the manager, by Ron, and some of his employees who eventually became my employees when they dismantled the compliance unit, was that Mary Jo Shelton and other people who were in the field, because Mary Jo Shelton was over, with retail operations, they felt that the branch managers did not have to respond to the reports. And at one point, the word was that they were too busy trying to make money to respond to reports, so they didn't have to give them an answer. And I found that coming from a paper to be very, 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 crazy, I'll put it that way, for lack of a better word, because whenever you go out and do a quality, you issue a report, you know, you identify areas that need to be corrected, you need to know, you need to get feedback from the branch on how they're going to cure those problems, and they stopped that. And then to add insult to injury, when they create the business control division, one of the very first things they did was got rid of the compliance unit and put fraud investigation under the business control unit, and then that's when instead of my unit going out to do investigations, the investigations were, any allegations of fraud were being handled by the Human Resource Department, which means, and under the cover of the relationship that the Human Resource Department has with the field. They're there to support your branch operation, which I understand that. But when it came to allegations of fraud, that prior to our being realigned and put into this newly created division, that would come to the fraud investigation unit because that was our job. But what happened was when they did the realignment, we quit going out. They start. We would get phone calls from the human resource representatives asking us questions. What does this mean in the loan file? What does this mean? And what did that mean? Could you look at this for us? And that to me was another way of kind of watering down, reducing the exposure, because now you don't have a trained eye. You don't have experienced people looking at loans. You just have an HR person, and we can do it under the cover that, well, we heard Johnny was doing something funny in a loan, so we sent Mary out to the branch to talk to Johnny.
Do you think the restructuring that took place, and I think you said 2004, was done intentionally to increase revenues and increase business and decrease any obstructions to potential revenue raising?
I do.
And what is your basis for that?
Because of the people, number one, they pull us from underneath the legal department. They put us into a newly created division where the head of that division was a salesperson. And the relationship between Renee Dean and Mary Jo Shelton, between capital markets person and the person whose job is to make the loans and the person's job who is to sell the loans, those were the people that had control over us. And I felt that why would you put us, we should be basically an untouchable unit, that we report directly to legal and not to the field. But we were reporting to people who had a cozy relationships with the branch. And that didn't make any sense to me.
And were those bosses I know you said that they were salespeople, but after they took over that position, were they in fact being compensated based upon revenue goals and things and production goals?
I'm sure that everybody, we had MBOs, which is, managed business objectives. Everybody had those throughout the company that was at the executive level. So I'm sure that there were some compensation, for hitting their targets, because it was kind of crazy, because we were doing, outlandish numbers in 2004 and going into 2005. We were from million to billions. And the thing that doesn't make sense to me is that no one asked a simple question. Why, if you go from doing millions to billions, what are you doing that is so good that got you there? From a million to all of a sudden you're doing billion. And that would be, to me, a red flag, which was a red flag for us to look more closely at the loans to make sure that when we went through everything. As a matter of fact, if you ever get a copy of the deposition of Mike Gibson in my arbitration thing, you will find out Mike Gibson made the comment that the purpose, who was my boss, and that's who goes back to my Ames days. When he was at Ames, I busted the branch that he was at. I think he was the manager, and we uncovered fraud in his branch. We didn't know that. I didn't know that at the time until we got to Ameriquest that our path had crossed. But Mike Gibson stated in his deposition that the fraud investigation unit purpose was not to uncover fraud, but to be reactive, not to be proactive. And that's contrary to what fraud investigation is all about. Yes, we are reactive when we find there's a problem, but proactive means when we get a file and if it's one incident, we need to find out and sweep all of those files and make sure that based on a representative sample that there aren't any more issues there. We're not just going to say, okay, it's one file, that's the only file we're going to look at. Well, you can almost bet your dot and bottler that if it's one file, there may be 15, 20, or 30 more.
Let me ask you this. Is there any doubt in your mind that the restructuring resulted in extremely poor quality loans being pushed through the system, through the conduit, and ultimately contributed to the collapse of the housing market? And specifically, what I'm getting at is, to what degree did the restructuring and the other types of conduct that occurred that encourage fraudulent activity, to what extent did that ultimately lead to AmeriQuest's collapse, as well as potentially allowing these toxic assets in the form of CDOs, et cetera, to spread throughout the domestic economy as well as the world economy, for that matter?
Well, I'll try to answer it the best way. I'll try to answer the best way I can. Number one, they removed the fraud investigation unit. They neutralized us by placing us in the business controls unit, which basically took our responsibilities and really formed them out to the HR department, which kind of sent a signal to the field that they no longer have to worry about us knocking on their doors, coming through, surprise them in the morning when the branch opens. So they, the method in which we looked at loans, our review period was where we would look at the entire loan file. We would look at each section to see if there was any other discrepancies or defects in the file. Under the business control division, the marching orders were to only look if there was an appraisal issue, just look for an appraisal issue. Don't look for anything else. And that's what changed. And then also, the people that were going out into the branches were people that from HR and people from another area called production control that had no mortgage loan fraud investigation background or no experience. So people in the branch, it became very obviously we're not seeing the fraud investigation unit coming out. We have people who have no idea. Oh, there's former salespeople.
Mr. Parker, how big was your fraud investigation unit?
We got up to maybe about 10 to 15 people. Then we created a special audit unit, which was another 10 to 15 people. So about 10 to 15 people. And
now, that's in the investigation unit, and then there's an additional 10 to 15 in the audit unit?
In a special audit unit, which was another unit that was created.
Okay, so you had about 30 people.
Anywhere in there, I'd say almost 40, 35 to 40 people when you put the two units together.
Okay.
And special audit, I'm sorry, but special audit didn't come to me until after they had a special audit manager. He left, and then I inherited the department, and then I staffed it and changed the directions in terms of how to look at, to conduct investigations.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Sorry, once the restructuring occurred and the obstructions were taken out of the way and you guys were, in essence, neutralized, how dramatically did the volume of loans increase?
Well, with us, I'm sure they were still doing billions. They were doing billions until, this whole thing got, people start defaulting and, and things start happening, that bubble burst. But they were doing record volumes. I mean, we were no longer involved, so they were doing, there was nobody watching what was going on. I mean, the people that were out there, they were out there looking for something. They didn't know what they were looking for. So, I mean, as far as the company is concerned, I mean, yeah, they could point that we had some people looking, but the fraud investigation was no longer, our role was reduced to basically being a customer service type of function. If the people that are out in the field that were going out, HR, are the people from production control who were salespeople going out, they would call and ask us, well, can you tell me what this is and what does this mean and yada, yada. So, when I saw the picture, there was nothing to stop them from doing the volume, and that's why volume, if you look, you would probably see that volume did continue to increase around that period of time when they created the business control division, because I mean they had us. There was nothing. Who's going to stop them? Go ahead.
Let me ask you this: you said that AmeriQuest business went from the millions into the billions. And that the loan volume increased, you said loan volume increased after the creation of the business control division. But yet you only had, at any one point in time, a max of approximately 15 investigators for a $1 billion loan company. Did you ever go to management and say, listen, or did anybody from quality assurance, you know, prior to the whole restructuring, as you call it, was there ever like, listen, like, we're getting swamped, we need more investigators, there's lots coming through? Or was it kind of, because it seems like as your loan volume increased, everything in quality control and fraud investigations kind of stayed the same.
No, quality control, the quality control department expanded. My department, we expanded, but we were, you know, based on the work that we were getting after they pulled us out of the legal department, put us under business control, we weren't getting a lot of, I mean, our parameters in which we were allowed to look had changed. And so the direction, and that's when they basically, you know, they changed the way they wanted. The referrals wasn't coming to us. Case in point, the HR would get a situation. Normally when an allegation of fraud would come in prior to the restructuring, it would come to the fraud investigation unit. But what was happening after the restructuring, allegations of investigations was going through the HR department first from legal, and they would then filter it out to us, you know, if there were some concerns or something that they couldn't handle, whatever. But it was filtered. Things were being filtered.
Okay. Now, I just want to make sure I have the numbers right. So after the restructuring, your investigation unit numbers increased?
No. Our investigation numbers didn't increase. What happened was we would only get things that were referred to us by
sir, the legal department. I'm talking about your personnel.
Personnel? No, our numbers increased. No, our numbers didn't increase because what happened was when production control came into the picture. Mike Gibson Group under Renee Dean came into the picture, and they started the change came about, which means that some of the functions that we used to do were now being done by production control. So we weren't really getting we weren't exclusively fraud investigation. We weren't getting that all the fraud investigation pieces were being handpicked and given to us, but total fraud investigations, all allegations of fraud were not being given to the department. And, you know, they were being, some of it was being handled through production control. And again, as I stated earlier, this was a case where the issues were coming through the door, and because of the departments and the way the division was structured, they were able to determine what came to us and what did not come to us, and at what point it did come to us. So that was a way of controlling, you know, the investigation. And basically, we were just there. It was just whatever they gave us. You know, it was just unfortunate, but that's the way it was.
Mr. Parker, what did you do to deserve? In Mr. Hudson's article, it said that they called you Darth Vader. I mean, it sounds like if you only had about, you know, 25 to 50 fraud reports over a two-year period, I mean, that's like one or two a month. I mean, were you really crushing? Was your department or the fraud investigations unit, I mean, shutting down huge fraud rings, or was this just a way for management to say, we don't like you?
No, we were doing our jobs. We were, as I was told, and in one meeting by Dan Sweeney, I forgot what Dan's position was, but he was a VP or something. And they said we were looking, discussing a loan file. And he said, you give this one file to Ed, and it will probably end up being 100 loan files. No, to answer your question, yeah. The reason I was called Darth Vader was actually there was a comment prior to that one. It was that when the Michigan investigation, which was my first, I wasn't there a complete whole month, maybe about a month, yeah, just a little over a month. I was told I hit the mother load, you know, and I was told that when the branches are not happy to see me, you know, because, you know, I remind them of Darth Vader, you know. And then I was told when business control took over, one of the complaints they had against my department was that we looked for too much, that they wanted to shorten the time. They wanted a quicker turnaround time. They wanted us to not look for everything in the file, just basically, if it says it's a cut and paste, look and see if it's a cut and paste, and don't look to see if there's any problems with the title, which we did find, if there's any problem with any of the other aspects of the loan file. So that's why I would be Darth Vader, because we didn't leave any stones unturned, because that's your job, to be thorough and to be diligent. You know. So if the investors, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Is that why they didn't want you to look at the boxes from the Orange County branch?
Right, right. That's correct. Because
now, who specifically told you don't look at that?
Well, I didn't. No one specifically told. It was told to one of my senior analysts, but we were never given any instructions to just hold on. We were delayed. Well, you know, when do you want us to look at this? Well, no, don't look at this. We will tell you. And then the unofficial version that came from someone in the company was that, you know, the company decided they're just going to box these up. So there were no but my people, we did look anyway, you know, because just to see what was in those boxes and see if there was, you know, what the issue that had driven this investigation and caused the company to box these files up, that those issues did exist. And based on our history, MiraQuest does not go out into a branch and box anything up and bring it back unless there's a problem.
Now, you're quoting in Mr. Hudson's article. It says, as they, you know, I'll read you the quote in a second, but it says, as they cracked open the files, they saw that falsified incomes and ages were a problem that went beyond two borrowers' loans. When senior managers discovered what the team was doing, Parker said they weren't happy, quote, they said, don't look anymore. Now, was that taken out of context, or did someone actually tell you or one of your team, don't look in those files?
It was told one of my team, we were not to look in the files.
Now, where did that come from specifically?
It came from outside counsel, from what I understand. And I can tell you the person, the team member told me was Gus McDaniels.
Gus McDaniels?
Yes, Gus McDaniels, G-U-S McDaniels. He was my senior analyst.
I'm sorry, can you spell the first name for me?
Sure, it's G as in Georgia, U-S, and McDaniels.
Okay.
M-C-D-A, I think it's N-I-E-L. And I'm not sure if it's with an S, but maybe with an S, McDaniels.
All right, so do you remember the outside counsel firm?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember who the outside counsel was that told McDaniels?
My understanding was it was Joanne Davies.
Is that the person or the firm?
No, that's outside counsel. And that's the person outside counsel that was assigned to work with the Fraud Investigation Unit.
Was McDaniels given a reason why not to look in the boxes? I mean, to tell somebody in the Fraud Investigations Unit not to look at fraud, that would seem to me like they're kind of obstructing their job.
It is.
Did you ever bring that up with either, would you say, Renee Dean, who is the head of the Business Control Division, or any of your other supervisors at AmeriQuest? I mean, why you were being kind of hamstrung?
You know, I talked to, Renee Dean very had any little interaction with me.
Okay.
So, you know, they weren't around me. I basically, all of my communications were via reports are through outside counsel who worked very closely with me, Joanne Davies. So, but I will say that I know that when they created the position, they put for director of quality control, after they did the restructuring, I appointed Deborah McDonald, who was my counterpart in quality control, and I never got a chance to interview for the position, so I went and questioned Renee Dean on that, and just asked her, why wasn't I given a chance to interview? Because I know I have experience, and plus we were using systems that Deborah wasn't familiar with. So she said that Deborah had a lot of experience. So, I mean, I just said, well, I know I make the difference, you know, because I know I've looked at the quality control reports, and I also know that, when I first started, one of the first things that I tried to do was reach out to the QC department, because they are a source that we could use in fraud investigation. It's, you know, there are coordinated functionalities within my world. You know, there's compliance and quality control and internal audits. All those units, they have different roles, but they work together, you know, to, provide some type of risk management plan for a company. But I didn't get that.
All right, Mr. Park, I guess I wasn't clear in my question. Did you find it odd, and did you bring it up with anybody in management about, you know, there's all these boxes from this branch or frauds identified, and you find rampant fraud that's outside of the two loan files that were suggested in the article?
No, I don't recall talking to anybody about it specifically, because once I understood the word was that they didn't want to look at it, and that we were getting ready to box the files and ship them out. No, I did not. I didn't ask anybody about it.
Did you find it odd?
Yes. Well, we knew, you know, they didn't want to look, because that was AmeriQuest. I mean, I've been fighting this since I've been in here. Okay, so that, I mean, the demeanor of the company was one that they did not want to, they didn't want to uncover any more problems, and that's why, you know, I mean, you have the advent of what they've already done to me. They've already neutralized my department. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So I mean, who can I go to in the department, in the company is going to listen to me when they've already taken away my responsibilities, stripped us of our function, of what we do, and we were relegated to just being there as a source for HR and other people that were going out into the branches doing what we were supposed to do. So we were, you know, what can I do? There was nobody in the company to go to, nobody was going to listen to me. So what could I do?
Yeah, ultimately, was that the reason for your leaving the company?
My leaving the company?
Yes.
No, I was, that's an interesting story. I was supposedly let go, laid off, okay? However, that was in May of 2006, but in November of 2005, we're doing my arbitration with AmeriQuest. There was an email that went out that said now would be a good time to let Mr. Parker go, because they had demoted me from a manager to a supervisor under the cover of they wanted to bring someone in with a law enforcement and criminal background to head up the fraud investigation unit. And which they never did, but that, you know, when they demoted me, I was supposed to go, and I didn't go, and I didn't find it out until arbitration that email had circulated from Ginger Crawford to Mike Gibson that now would be a good time to offer me a package, which they did, but I said no. Yeah.
So you were downgraded from a supervisor to a manager.
From a manager to a supervisor, I was downgraded.
Manager, supervisor, sorry.
And ultimately, what was the reason for their laying you off, in your opinion?
According to the official version, that the company had laid off they had closed all the branches, and there was no need for my services anymore, and that they were going to keep the people. They were going to keep a few people around to mop up, clean up, an interesting thing about that, this is around the time that they had the multi-state settlement agreement with the attorney generals around the country. And if I recall distinctively, that agreement spelled out that AmeriQuest agreed to make sure that they have more confident people, looking at loans and, evaluating and, and being basically the fraud watchdog. But the people that they kept behind were people that were not your more seasoned people. And you would think they would have kept me, but they didn't keep me, and they didn't keep my more seasoned people. They kept people that had less experience. The three of them. That was Jessica Peters, Kara Colvin, and Jeff Dresser.
Okay. Now, if we were going to attempt to obtain documentation to provide evidence of institutionalization of fraud at AmeriQuest, what recommendations do you have to obtain those documents?
I would say you can start by requesting. I have documents from my deposition that AmeriQuest had to provide to my attorney, which would be emails and things like that. My only concern would be, and this is something that I'm very grateful and very hopeful. AmeriQuest always used the attorney-client privilege, and this is one of the things that their attorneys in arbitration kept raising the issue that this is attorney-client privilege. But I know that if you have access to those documents, you will see the institutional fraud. You will see what I told you about circumventing and how they changed the business model to be able to, neutralize us and do what they need to do. And sales people took over and ran business control and basically dictated to fraud investigation what they want to do. So if you can get your hands on my reports, and like say I have copies of all of my my lawyer sent to me my depositions, and in it there are some there are emails and things and depositions of all the people that like Mike Gibson, Ginger Crawford, Lachelle Buford, who was also a member, Carol Colvin. There are depositions and documents that could be very helpful to you.
And who would have possession of your reports at this point?
With AmeriQuest reports would be AmeriQuest, I guess. AC Capital Holdings, you would have to get it from them.
But do you know who specifically would have those and what department?
No, I don't. AmeriQuest is no longer around, so I don't know. ACC Capital, you would have to the custodian of records, whoever the custodian of records. I don't know how that process works, but I believe that there is a custodian of records that someone in the company should be someone within the parent organization should be able to provide you with those documents. Because if you get the documents, you'll see the investigations. You'll see the reports on debt omissions and appraisals and cut and paste, and you'll see the report on the Northern California report, which was a report that was that I was asked to do on specifically stated back loans in response to, at that time, California Attorney General Lockley, I think his name is. AmeriQuest had received a substantial amount of complaints. And so we looked at stated loans, and that report was generated. And what we found was signatures that were exactly the same handwriting, similar handwritings on a lot of the stated loans. We found a pattern where people were the same name, the same type of occupation kept appearing over and over again. And the evidence is there. The documentation is there. So, and it was a high percentage, And then there were people, like you have a person that's a domestic person, a housekeeper, making $5,000 a month, Okay.
Wow.
So those are the kind of things. And if you can get, if you can get your hands on my reports, and I'll be more than happy, as long as, I don't want to, get sued or anything for giving deposition paper, but I believe depositions are in the public domain, I believe. If you can, get your clearance or whatever, I'd be more than happy to to, get you the copies of the depositions that I have, because it does have emails, and because during the arbitration, the request is due for me with the process, they have to exchange documents and stuff, so I do have copies of that.
Mr. Parker, I really only have one final question. Since you were kind of in the business in the late 80s, early 90s, did you have any experience with a stated income loan back then? And if so, you know, they weren't really performing loans back then. Did you ever caution Ameriquest, you know, in the next round in the early 2000s about the use of the stated income loan?
Stated loans were originally for self-employed people. Okay?
Right.
Not wage earners. You know?
Right.
And when you start seeing a 1003, God, I haven't used that expression in a long time. You start seeing a 1003 says that, you know, John and Mary Doe work for Acme Cafe, and it's a stated loan. That's a red flag. Yeah. That's a red flag because I came from A paper, you know, so CalFam was A paper, and you start seeing stuff like that, you know, something's wrong, you know.
What percentage of the loans do you feel were fraudulent? But starting in the year 2004 and moving forward?
I don't want to be conservative, but I would say that probably greater than probably about anywhere between 60-75%. And the reason I say that is because, no one was watching. I mean, you know, the volume was up, and now you see the fallout, you know, behind the loan process, you know, loan origination, the numbers. I mean, the numbers were there, but let me just say this. When I think this is probably where I got in trouble, when Renee Dean announced that she was going to be the head of business control, and they did this realignment, restructuring. Each department had to do a presentation on what their functions were. So I did a presentation on the fraud investigation unit. And one of the comments I made at that time, and this is right at the beginning when Ameriquest numbers were going up, I made the comment that, in my department, you know, I'd say, most people look at the numbers and they get happy. That's fine. But for us, when we look at numbers, we become very concerned, you know, and I don't get happy. You know, I want to know, are we making these numbers because we have a good product? Are we making these loans because we're shortcutting? Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello? Okay.
Sir?
So, and maybe I shouldn't have made that comment, you know, but I didn't get happy.
Well, sir, what are you basing that number off of?
You asked me for a number, and I can't scientifically, I mean, I don't have any data because I'm a data person, but I don't have any data to tell you, but I'm just basing that number on the volume that they were doing, and just based on the fact that you had a case in Fresno as late 2005 where we were finding are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, we had a case in Fresno, California as late as 2005 where the branches were manipulating financial statements, and one of the things that happened was that report came out of my special audit unit, and I brought it up at an executive meeting of the fraud committee meeting we would have weekly, and then we started having biweekly, and I remember bringing that up, and that somebody. The people that were associated with the manipulations of the documents in those files out of the Fresno area were now branch managers. And so Ginger Crawford, who was the HR manager at that time, sitting at the in a meeting, I asked the question. I said, well, what are we going to do about this? You know, we have these loan executives that are now, we know why they were promoted because of their numbers, and we know why they had the numbers because they were manipulating documents, you know. And she, her statement, her response to me was that, well, you know, it's kind of like we can't do anything about it because we didn't approach them before we promoted them. But so my next question was, is there a statute of limitation when it comes to fraud?
Right.
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was, you know, I mean, you guys have been, you know, I haven't talked about this in, other than with Mike in a while, but I had to go back and just kind of, you know, reconstruct my experience because, you know, it was one hell of, excuse my expression, one hell of an experience. You know, you go in, you know, wanting to do your job, and I kind of walked away from my AmeriQuest experience believing that my job was to be the poster child, you know, to say, and I came in right at the time when AmeriQuest, apparently, I think the state was looking at them and they were getting a lot of complaints, and I was supposed to come in and be that poster child to say that, you know, we are doing our best. We have this gentleman here, he's controlling fraud, but they didn't expect me to really do my job. And that's why I hit the motor load, and that's why I became Darth Vader. You know,
Mr. Parker, what was your compensation when you were at AmeriQuest?
What was my butt?
Your compensation, like what were you paid?
When I started, I was at 55. And I had to fight to get an increase. And finally, when I left, I was at around close to 80. I think I was around 79, 560, something like that.
Okay, and how did that compare to the producers that were, you know, bringing in the loans or closing the loans, et cetera?
Oh, that was nothing. I mean, we went to a branch in Elmont, New York. That's one of my other investigations, and we used to have a little banter among ourselves. Meaning, one of the investigators, my thing was, you can tell if the AmeriQuest employees are ours, because they were the ones that were the nice, you know, the SUVs, the more exotic cars. We had loan coordinators, to answer your question specifically, the loan coordinators, they made a lot of money, okay, and you have one branch in Elmont, New York specifically, guys are making easily 14,000, you know, 7,000, 14,000 a month. That was easy, you know, and they made a lot of money. I mean, no disrespect to a loan coordinator, but yeah, they had loan coordinators that had a house and going on a second house. I mean, they were making money, you know, and that was the bottom line. They were making money. You know, it had nothing to do with quality. It had to turn, you know, the thing was to turn over the loans, you know, make sure that we get them in because we weren't holding on to them anyway. We were just going to get them in and they're going to sell them out the back door. You know, and leave the bars hanging, and then bars go down the street, and they find out that, yeah, well, guess what? Your property is not worth that; it's less. So now you're upside down. And,
right.
Yeah, that story played out too many times.
Right. Mr. Parker, I don't have any more questions. Jeff, do you have anything? Jeff.
Yes.
Do you have any more questions?
No, I'm good. Sorry about that. We got disconnected.
Okay. Mr. Parker, I want to thank you again for your time. I hope you didn't take up too much of your evening kind of rehashing the past at AmeriQuest.
Yeah, well, let me just say one thing. You asked me for a number of reports, 25 to 50. It could be less. It could be more. I don't remember exactly those numbers, but I do know that if you get your hands on my reports, reports from the Fraud Investigation Unit, and you get it from the beginning, all the reports up until 2003 to 2006, when they 2005, you will see the transition. You will see how things dropped off, and you will see a lot of changes. So I hope I was able to answer your questions and to the best, you know, of my recollection, and I hope I've been very helpful to you.
Yeah, we appreciate it very much.
Well, you're welcome. Anytime.
All right, thank you.
Okay,
I'm going to go ahead and. All right, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording now. It is 10:41 Eastern Time.
Okay.
All right, thank you, sir. And so, if we have any follow-up questions, we can contact you.
Feel free to.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome. Take care. All right. Bye.